Well, it is good to see everybody here this evening, and I do want to echo once again what's already been said to our visitors. We certainly hope that your participation in our worship service has been edifying so far. One thing to understand about truth, though, is that sometimes truth is very, very challenging. And if you're visiting with us this evening and you were expecting the typical kind of gospel sermon, then I'll tell you in advance that this is going to be a very challenging topic for us to talk about. Our world is a world that is constantly in flux. Morals and ethics are constantly being changed, rearranged, questioned, reordered as each generation comes and another generation comes after that. Things that we thought were just totally unthinkable at one point go through a process of becoming debatable. And eventually those things that are debatable become justifiable. And eventually the things that we justify become unexceptionable. Now, it's not to say that the moral and ethical problems that we face today are things that humanity has never faced. But in terms of morals and ethics, we tend to go through cycles. The things that are very, very ugly on planet Earth right now might be very new to us, or so it seems, but they were just the ugly things that happened 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Morals change, but I think that, and this is my honest opinion, but I think that the balance of moral and immoral is always the same. People think, oh, we're going down such a bad path as a country and our morals are getting so bad. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think every generation has its issues that it pushes, and every generation kind of has its victories also over maybe the previous generation's faults and failures. But sadly, I think some of the things that we face today are maybe more shocking than immoral situations we've faced in previous generations in this country. And I'll give you a good example. From a periodical called Evolution News and Views, one writer, Wesley Smith, said, "The late Richard John Newhouse famously wrote of bioethicists, 'Thousands of medical ethicists and bioethicists, as they are called, professionally guide the unthinkable on its passage through the debatable on the way to becoming the justifiable until it's finally established as unexceptionable. In my years engaged in trying to push back against the bioethics movement,' he says, I have found that to be an absolutely accurate formula. Take as one example, the dehydrating of the cognitively devastated to death." What he means is that those who are cognitively without any capabilities any longer are simply dehydrated to death instead of overtly killed. "It's a slow and potentially agonizing process. That once was unthinkable," he says. "It became debatable in the 1980s, and it is now unexceptional. Allowing infanticide," and that's our subject for the day, "allowing infanticide, in his opinion, has now reached the debatable on the way to justifiable stage, with some of the world's most prominent bioethicists and medical journals publishing apologies for infanticide." The latest example is this. The Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery hosted a debate on infanticide in which the prominent Canadian bioethicist Udo Schoenflink argues in favor of its propriety. "Killing severely ill or dying babies is okay, don't you know, because human beings don't have intrinsic dignity." According to him, sarcastically, it's all about a quality of life ethic. One person sums up the quality of life ethic this way, if you're not familiar with the terminology. "A quality of life ethic requires us to focus on a neonate's current and future quality of life as relevant decision-making criteria. We would ask questions such as, does this baby have the capacity for development to an extent that will allow him or her to have a life and not merely to be alive? If we reach the conclusion that it would not, we would have reason to conclude that his life is not worth living." My friends, infanticide is now. Infanticide is not a problem that we read about in a science fiction novel. Infanticide is not just an obscure philosopher's fantasy. Infanticide is now. And for the sake of the kids here, of course, we know we'll kind of keep things fairly generic. We're not going to describe specifics. We're not going to get into detail. And I might not even use any other euphemism for infanticide other than infanticide itself. We all know, as adults, what the term infanticide entails. We think of it in a Christian circle like this. We would think, who would ever do that? Who would ever make a philosophical, medical, or ethical argument in favor of destroying the smallest, most helpless, and most innocent members of our own species? How counterintuitive is that? And yet it's a real problem. And it's something that's becoming more commonplace with each passing year. The United States, for example, has an infant homicide rate that ranks 11th in the world for babies less than 1 year old, and it is first in the world for babies between 1 and 4 years old. But you know, we're a very advanced, modern civilization, aren't we? We don't practice all the barbaric things of generations before us. You know, aside from destroying our own offspring, whether in the womb or out of the womb immediately. Many factors contribute to this. There's a lot of reasons that people might destroy their own offspring. Economic hardships, unstable family situations, emotional or psychological problems, or the most famous one, of course, and the most common is the assumed suffering of the baby. There's a lot of things that we could talk about tonight, and I don't want to make this a 45-minute lesson on something as unpleasant as infanticide. So I want to focus our conversation tonight primarily on kind of the philosophical arguments that people offer in support of like institutionally supported infanticide. We're not going to talk about mothers drowning their own children because there's, I think, a lot of things to consider in a topic like that. The mother's depression or emotional state or psychological state, economic factors and that sort of thing. We don't have the time, and this simply isn't, I think, the setting to talk about specific cases of killing offspring. But again, what I want to focus on is the idea of hospital administrators, philosophers, university professors, politicians, institutionally endorsing the destruction of our offspring. It's going to be hard, by the way, for us to stay away from abortion, because I think abortion and infanticide kind of are topics that tend to blend a lot. But our main argument is this. There is a divergent worldview between those who argue for the sanctity of all human life and the quality or supposed quality of human life. Infanticide is not a new problem, by the way. It's actually a very ancient problem. From the Australian Aborigines, who would sometimes devour the destroyed offspring, to the pre-industrial Japanese, who actually have a word in Japanese called mabiki, which is the word they would use for thinning, like thinning out a rice paddy or thinning out an overgrown vegetable patch. They would use mabiki to refer to the thinning out of their own population. All the way back to the Israelites as well. The Israelites had to face infanticide of their own in their generation. It's noted in Leviticus chapter 20, verses 2 through 5, that it is absolutely imperative that the Israelites avoid any kind of participation in the detestable worship activities surrounding Molech and the other Canaanite gods. Molech, of course, was a god whose adherents believed that they had to offer their offspring to him as burnt sacrifices. This does crop up in their own history. You can see in Jeremiah 32 and 1 Kings 11 and 2 Kings 21 and verse 6 and 2 Chronicles chapter 28, a number of different references where the Israelites or the Judeans themselves got caught up in the practice of ritual infanticide in worshiping their pagan deities. Infanticide was frequently practiced in Rome as well. In fact, one writer says infanticide was infamously universal in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome. Indeed, so common was infanticide in ancient Greece that Polybius, blamed the decline of ancient Greece on that one contributing factor more than any other. What's most chilling about the practice is not that it was practiced by the Romans and the Greeks, but that it was so widespread, so common, and so approved of in their society. One writer said, not only was the exposure of infants a very common practice, it was justified by law and advocated by philosophers. Plato, Aristotle, Tacitus, Seneca, all endorsed the practice of institutionalized infanticide, especially for newborns that had physical deformities of some kind. We all know the story of Sparta. They wanted perfect babies in Sparta. And babies that were not born perfect according to their standards were cast out. They were left exposed to die on their own. Sparta is maybe the most famous of all the examples, but Rome was right up there with Sparta in terms of this being such an institutionalized and endorsed practice. The 12 tables of Roman law, for example, which were kind of the standards of Roman law, the 12 tables of Roman law gave explicit permission to a father to destroy the life of his newborn for any reason that he deemed necessary. Explicit permission. Whatever you wanted, however the baby was lacking your approval, whatever way the baby was deformed or disabled, you destroy it. It's your prerogative as father. So what changed? Early Christians, for one thing. The Christians from the second century onward gained more power in the Roman Empire, more influence. Their population increased within the whole of the Roman Empire, and with it, influence. Early Christians were absolutely opposed to infanticide and abortion as well, and they considered both to be equal to murder. To the Christian, an infant, and really all human life to be precise, holds intrinsic spiritual value that goes beyond just pure pragmatism. Can you afford the baby? Do you want the baby? Will the baby be happy? Will the baby be disabled or deformed somehow? The Christian sees something that goes beyond merely the physical side of things, the pragmatic side of things. Whether male, female, perfect, imperfect, disabled, or fully formed, every single human being is created in God's image. And that's a truth that we affirm from our very beginning as a people to today in our own society. When you look at the ancient writings of early Christians, all of them, unanimously showed support for the ending, the abolishment of the practice of infanticide in the Roman Empire. Minucius Felix wrote to the Roman emperor one time, and this would have been in the 3rd century, "I see that at one time you expose your begotten children to wild beasts and to birds, and at another time that you crush them and strangle them with a miserable kind of death. And these things assuredly come down from your own gods, for Saturn did not expose his own children. Saturn devoured them." I think it's interesting there what he's saying is, you learned this practice from your own pagan religion. Your own religion says that Saturn consumed his children, and you've now picked up on the moral cues of your pagan religion. Question then, for practical application, do we reflect the God that we believe in? The Romans reflected their gods. Their gods were wicked. Their gods were flawed. Their gods were hedonists. They indulged in every kind of pleasure and every kind of fancy. Their gods were reckless and immoral and greedy and squabbling. And the Romans reflected their gods. The true God of this universe is perfect and all-knowing. He is all-loving and omniscient. He's omnipotent and omnipresent. He reflects love in every corner of the world. And as his people, wherever we go, in every corner of the world, do we show the same kind of love? Do we show the same kind of respect for the life that he has created on planet Earth? In the 1970s, new voices were calling for a re-examination of the ethical implications of infanticide. The landmark Roe versus Wade decision in the Supreme Court of 1973 actually kind of opened the door for more conversations when it came to life in the womb and the value of human life and the sanctity of human life itself. This opened the door for a new wave of bioethicists to discuss their views without any of the social stigma that they experienced in the 1950s and 60s. In 1983, the respected publication Pediatrics printed an article by philosopher Peter Singer, which I quoted this morning, by the way. This is a Peter Singer day, I guess. But they quoted the philosopher Peter Singer, in which he provided rationale for infanticide in the case of severely handicapped newborns. He notes, "We can no longer base our ethics on the idea that human beings are a special form of creation made in the image of God," which is basically taking the entire sanctity of life argument, wrapping it up, crushing it up, and throwing it into the trash can, and saying that holds no value anymore. That's not how we're going to interpret human life any longer. We're not made in the image of God, singled out from all other animals, and alone in possessing an immortal soul. In 1979, a few years before that, he said, "Human babies are not born self-aware. They are not capable of grasping that they exist over time. They are not persons. The life of a newborn is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee." The reason why he says that is because at least a pig or a dog or a chimpanzee have some sense of self-awareness. When you look at a newborn baby, it knows nothing. It doesn't see anything or understand anything. It doesn't look around. You can't show it the mirror and say, "Ah, self-awareness! See thyself, young lad." Because that's how I talk. But because a newborn does not have that kind of cognitive ability to understand its own existence, it doesn't have the right to existence. Yet a chimpanzee can finger paint. So it must have more value than a human baby. I don't know. You know, kind of when I peel away the layers of that and take away any kind of Christian argumentation on that, you know, any Bible verse or anything like that, just take that all away. From a purely member of our species standpoint, don't you find that a little bit reprehensible? Like, these are our offspring. This is the human species we're talking about. And you consider a chimpanzee, a pig, or a dog to hold more value than the offspring in your own species. I don't know. One wonders. Peter Singer, like we talked about this morning in our sermon, his idea is for us to all just get sterilized and go extinct. I kind of wonder, like, what does he really think our place in the world actually is? Do we have any value at all in his thinking, in his mind? For Singer and other people like him, it is self-consciousness that makes a human life worth anything. Self-awareness, rationality, understanding the concept of time, and having a basic capacity for thinking are all necessary for a lump of human flesh to be considered a person with inherent, inalienable rights to life. Joseph Fletcher, who wrote a pretty infamous book called Situation Ethics, actually said, in his own opinion, that we ought to place an IQ minimum to consider people worthy of personhood. That if you have an IQ of less than 45, you should not actually be considered a human person. And while this all seems very shocking to us, this seems shocking, doesn't it? While it seems shocking to us, we have to understand that for philosophers and ethicists who hold these values, this is simply a consistent approach that fits their preconception. That preconception is that we don't have an eternal soul and that there is no eternal destination for that soul after we die. They're pragmatists. And of course, I give Peter Singer credit and Joseph Fletcher and Richard Dawkins. I give them credit for at least being consistent. When they asked Richard Dawkins earlier this year over the summer, What would you do, or what would be the moral or ethical thing to do if you knew that someone in the womb had Down syndrome? I give Richard Dawkins a ton of credit for at least being consistent in saying the moral, ethical thing to do is to abort a fetus if you know that it has Down syndrome. At least he's being consistent with that. At least they're being consistent. Because if a life is not worth saving, then it's a life that shouldn't be saved. If a human will not contribute to society, then he shouldn't be a part of society. If a baby is unwanted or will bring economic hardships on the mother, if a baby has mental or physical disabilities that will reduce his or her assumed level of happiness, why not kill it? That's the consistent answer. That's the consistent answer. Why not kill it? To people like this, the ultimate goal of human existence is to achieve as much happiness as possible. Why? Because you get one life to live on planet Earth. Do you want that life to be a life of suffering or a life of happiness? Of course you want it to be a life of happiness. If you get one life on planet Earth, you don't want it to be a life of suffering. If we get one life on planet Earth, we must get as much happiness as possible and reduce as much suffering as possible, so as to make the most of this one life that we have. So again, it makes sense. It makes sense. Talk to any secular humanist, and the main goal of life is to increase happiness and reduce suffering on planet Earth. That is the reason why we live. And you can immediately see that there is a huge difference between those who argue for the sanctity of human life versus those who argue for the quality of human life. For an unbelieving pragmatist, any life that lacks a high degree of quality is essentially a life that's not worth living. If you don't have a high quality of life, why are you even alive? If you're disabled, if you're deformed, if you're going to enter into economic hardships, if you're not wanted, or you're not loved, or you're not desired, or you don't have a family, or you don't have a place, or you're going to be a hardship on society, that is a low quality of life, and it is not a life that's worth living. From our worldview, this is ghoulish. It's sickening. But it's the most common philosophical argument in support of infanticide. It immediately breaks down, though, when you consider the fact that quality of life and the inherent right to life do not go hand in hand. I'll give you a good historical example, okay? You remember back in 1857, right? What was the big deal in 1857? What was the big Supreme Court case? Come on, high schoolers who just took American history. The Dred Scott decision of 1857, right? The Supreme Court of the United States of America came down with a decision that black slaves had absolutely no legal rights whatsoever. Why? Because black slaves were not fully persons under the law. They were property. They were things, chattel. If you wanted to kill a slave, you could kill a slave. It was your slave. Do with it what you want. If you want to put him to work, put him to work. It's your slave. Do with him what you want. Slaves had no rights in the United States of America, legally speaking, because they were not persons under the law. They had no freedom to play music, produce art or poetry. They couldn't go where they wanted to, do what they wanted to, be what they wanted to. There was no self-determination. They could not express their opinions. They could not operate on a day-to-day basis without constantly being under the threat of violence. That sounds like a pretty low quality of life to me. Don't you think that's a pretty low quality of life? They had an extremely low quality of life and almost no expectation whatsoever for happiness on planet Earth. Any argument that is based on determining a person's value from economic standing, from mental ability, from physical ability, or independence is one that runs completely contrary to logic and compassion. Value is not determined by human achievement. And value is not determined by your IQ. And value is never determined by your relationship to a master or an owner or any other human being who assigns a worldly value to you. You are not valuable because somebody else says you're valuable. You're not worthless because somebody else says you're worthless. Your value comes from God alone. Your value comes from God alone. You're created in God's image, according to Genesis 1, verses 26 through 28. You are masterfully crafted in the womb with a sense of identity before you are even born. Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. And I like this. The words that are used to describe an unborn child in both the Hebrew in Exodus 21:22 and the Greek in Luke 1, verse 41 are also used in other contexts, both secular and biblical, of children who are born. What I mean by that is the Hebrews and the Greeks used the same word for a fetus and a newborn. We created the distinction, didn't we? We invented the distinction because it makes it more convenient. You're not killing a baby. The Hebrews and the Greeks had the exact same word for fetus and newborn. Well, what about this argument then of how is it ethical to knowingly let a disabled baby enter into a life of pain and hardship? Isn't the nice thing to do to look at a baby with some disability or a deformity and go, you know, he's going to have a hard life. It's going to be pain and suffering and hardship. He's never going to achieve things. He's always going to be an outcast. He's going to be looked down upon or doted on. Or, you know, let's prevent suffering. Let's just end this now so that the baby never has to go through a life of suffering. How can you argue that it's ethical to let that disabled baby enter into a life of suffering? I often wonder, though, and here's my consideration. I often wonder, whose life of suffering are you really worrying about? Is it so much the baby's quality of life that's your big problem? Or is it your own quality of life that's the problem? You realize that in the United States of America, the majority of abortions that take place legally in the United States of America are performed by middle class or upper middle class Americans. We think it's poor people, right? Poor people are always getting abortions. That's a complete misconception about abortions in the United States of America. It's preference. It's lifestyle. It's economics. The pragmatist might find this very repulsive, the idea of caring for the weak and the innocent, the idea of seeing a person as something more than just their achievements or abilities or their IQ. Here's the thing, though. Who are we to decide a person's quality of life before they've even had a life to live? I think that's kind of my biggest issue is you've looked at a person and you've said, I foresee his or her life turning out like this. And I'm going to make a decision on his or her behalf in advance without any concrete evidence whatsoever. I'm going to make a decision for that person. I don't know. Who are we to decide what a person's quality of life is before they've ever had a life? And is life supposed to just be about happiness? Quality of life can sometimes only be seen in hindsight. What are some of the highest moments of your life? They're the moments that come immediately after your lows. When you've fought through something, struggled through something, when you've had to strive, when you've suffered. But then you get to the end of the suffering, you get to the end of the struggle, and you realize the struggling was doing something for me. My quality of life is not determined because of the suffering. My quality of life is determined by the lessons I learned because of the suffering. Because of the joy that's felt after the suffering. Romans chapter 5, for example. Notice Romans 5, verses 3 through 5. And not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance brings about proven character, and proven character brings about hope, and hope does not disappoint. Go to James chapter 1. We read it pretty often because it's a great verse. In James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Do you ever want to get to the perfect and complete, lacking in nothing? You ever want to get to that part of it? You have to go through the suffering to get there. Nobody gets to perfect and complete, lacking in nothing, until they've been through the hardship and the tribulation and the suffering. So I don't buy it when you tell me that it's merciful or ethical to end a person's life before they've ever had a chance to live it because they won't have a high quality of life. Quality of life can only be determined in hindsight. When you look back on the life that you've lived and you said, you know what, it was a hard life, it was a life of struggle, it wasn't always the life I wanted or thought I would have. But because of the struggles, because I overcame, it was a quality life. The ever popular happiness scale. That's the whole point behind pragmatism, secular humanism. That's the whole point. The whole point is we have got to balance the scales, or in some way tip the scales in favor of happiness. Happiness and suffering. Happiness and suffering. Peter Singer, here's one more quote for you, okay? This is the last time I'll quote Peter Singer for the day because you're probably getting tired of him. According to Peter Singer, when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. The loss of the happy life for the first infant is outweighed by the gain of a happier life for the second. Therefore, if killing the hemophiliac infant has no adverse effect on others, because it never does, of course, it would, according to the total view, be right to kill him. If you can increase happiness in the world somehow or another by killing a baby, then it is right to do it. For men like him, it is always about the ever-precious scale of happiness in the world. Alleviate suffering, increase happiness, no matter what God might have to say about it. Contrary to this view, the Bible makes it clear that happiness is not really the point of life at all. We may be happy or sad. We may be healthy or sick. We may be fully formed or disabled. We might be in any kind of condition, under any kind of circumstances, and we still have access to a spiritual contentment that goes beyond mere happiness. According to Philippians chapter 3 and verse 17, brethren, join in following my example, and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. For many walk, of whom I often told you, and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, and whose glory is in their shame. And they set their minds on earthly things. Our citizenship, though, is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform the body of our humble state into conformity with the body of His glory, by the exertion of the power that He has, even to subject all things to Himself. How can you deny that to a baby with a deformity? How can you deny the opportunity to live a life for God, to live a life for Christ through thick and thin, in suffering and in times of pleasure, so that that person can see life to the end and realize that there is something, a reward, waiting for them after a life of struggle and suffering? To see the humble state that we're in, with all of our flaws, with all of our deformities, all of our ailments, and to see this humble state conformed with the body of glory by the exertion of God's own power. Our goal is not to be happy, but to be spiritually filled through service to both God and man. Our way to completeness in life is only found in Christ. Now, I know it's an interesting topic to talk about. Not the sort of topic where you're going to preach it and people are going to come running down the aisles to get baptized. But I always want to offer the opportunity. If this is something that's been on your mind, if you've been studying, or if you'd like an opportunity to study a little bit further, sit down with somebody from our congregation in a Bible study, you'd like to hear the message of the gospel. If you'd like to see Philippians 3, 17 through 21 played out in your own life, see this humble state changed, transformed into a body of glory, you've got to be a Christian to do it. So I encourage you, whatever need you might have this evening, please come forward as we stand and